Hi, Mage fans. This is your host, Terry Robinson, with Mage the Podcast. And today's episode is a episode of Walking into Shadow that I did in January that I said I would have out in winter. I guess I just didn't specify which. Where we play a game that the host calls Wheel of Paradigm, where you pick an effect and a paradigm and try and justify it. I thought it was a neat premise. It proved to be a much more wide-ranging discussion on Magic and M20. It is interesting hearing Sataros describe how magic works in his mind. The original conversation was about 2.5 hours long. I cut it down significantly. I pop in here and there to kind of explain what we were talking about when we do make a sudden jump. Also, before we start, Other Worlds Illuminated, a mage-made hard guide to the Umbra, is out on Storyteller's Vault. It is 50 pages explaining everything we know about the M20 Umbra, most of the systems that we've provided, and what holes remain, and how that kind of squares with previous editions. It covers as much as I could. The one thing that I don't go into super detail is the digital web, because that is pretty well covered, actually, in M20 Core, and then again in Operatives Dossier. And with that, on with the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Walking into Shadow, Mage the Ascension 20th Anniversary Introductory Series. My name is Simon. I am your host, and with me tonight are Terry Robinson of Mage the Podcast and Sotiris Filibrocato. Actually, gentlemen, would you mind just saying hello, and then I can check our levels?
Hey, okay. Everybody. I'm Sotiris Filibrocato, that damn mage guy. You probably know who I am by now.
Hi, my name is Terry Robinson. I am one of the hosts of Mage the Podcast and done a smattering of writing for M20 and for the Storyteller's Vault as well.
Why we're coming to Sphere Magic is because it is one of the most unique things about Mage and is also just something that you need a little bit of help for. And I don't think I would have gotten there were it not for Hero Games and Hero System, because all of that is effects-based, and a lot of the books give you just very concrete examples of how to build a power. It's a power building system rather than a power choosing system. And arguably Mage works very much the same way in practice, in that you have a goal you want to achieve. How do you make the mechanics do that? And you do that by combining your levels in the different spheres of magic, rolling your erite, your sort of general enlightenment to create the effect, and then casting the effect. But what that does involve is some buildup to it. How do you do that? What do you need to put together? So one of the things I thought we'd do, well, tonight's main feature is Wheel of Paradigms, where we will be taking effect suggestions and giving our interpretation of how to create that using Sphere Magic. We'll be choosing our own faction and the sort of remainder of the factors so that we can cop out and say, okay, so the Order of Hermes does it like this. And that basically means they wave a wand and draw a circle on the ground and stuff happens. But please, if you have effect suggestions, put them in the chat. If you just want to know, how do I cast this spell? One of the things I would like to do just to begin is if we could sort of briefly go over what each of the 9 spheres of magic cover. Would also maybe, if we could, get a bit of insight into why they were specifically chosen, why they were picked. Terry, would you mind going through, say, the first couple of spheres?
Sure.
2 or 3.
I'll just go through alphabetically. So the spheres in Mage are an attempt to kind of break down all possible bits of reality into domains that can be modified and influenced by a mage. It is the case that they are not perfectly aligned and with how one would think of it. And that, to me, is perfectly fine. Different groups are going to have different interpretations of it. So one of my favorites is in Sorcerer's Crusade, if you're a member of the Order of Reason, you don't really view it as the Sphere of Entropy. Maybe you view it as the Sphere of Fortune. And just kind of that renaming gives you an idea of what it can do. Revised kind of gave us alternate spheres, and then that was carried through in M20. The idea that even within the Battle of Paradigms, there is a battle of what each sphere does. So I kind of like the idea that there is also this battle of notions amongst mages on, so what does correspondence actually mean? And that is the first of the spheres. In the traditions, it is held by the seat of correspondence is held by the Virtual Adepts or the Mercurian Elites, my boys. And it covers connections and dimensions. It is both the interpretation and understanding of places, objects, and people as spaces and objects, as well as the connections between them, to the point where in previous editions, it's known as the sphere of connection. The next one is entropy, which covers chance and mortality. And this is kind of the idea that complex systems are special unto themselves. And as you go up in dot level in entropy, you kind of get the idea that you're affecting different complex systems. At a lower level, it is simple games of chance or the ability to detect the skeins of fate being knotted up. At higher levels, you gain the ability to detect chance and mortality as it pertains to matter, then living people, and then ultimately ideas. Mage does a good job of recognizing the whole is not just the sum of its parts, and entropy very much focuses on the fact that complex and involved systems kind of have a behavior of their own. The seat of entropy in M20 is held by the Chakravani / the Thanatoi. Third sphere, the sphere of forces. This covers the classical forces. So it covers fire, it covers lightning, it covers heat and cold. This is an interesting one because as you kind of go up in sphere levels, it kind of gives you an idea of size as well as specificity. So if you need to make a very subtle adjustment or a very large adjustment, forces has kind of got your back. Forces has the lovely feature of it's what it says on the tin, and that's kind of something shared by all the pattern spheres, those that kind of affect a thing that you can see. The seat of forces is held by the Order of Hermes. The sphere of life covers what we would recognize as life, growing and adapting biological systems that have the ability to respond to their surroundings. It covers things that are still alive, as opposed to things that are dead, which eventually gets covered by the sphere of matter. This is held by the Verbena, who have the seed of life at lower levels. It is detecting life and healing. At higher levels, you can alter, transmute, and create novel life. The next is the sphere of matter, which is the ability to modify things. One of the fun things about Mage is we frequently talk about what is the goal of a wizard out in the world, and one of them could be like, turn lead into gold! And you're like, okay, that's matter too. Most starting characters can do that without difficulty. What now, buddy? And that's part of the fun of Mage.
And why we have the Rich Bastard's Guide to Magic.
Yes, and a lovely little unit entirely within the technocracy that is just out there trying to figure out why does this person have an extra $6 billion that we can't account for? So again, as you gain dots in matter, it indicates the scale, complexity, and refinement of your ability to affect non-living materials. The Society of Aether holds that chair within the Council of the Nine. The sphere of mind is kind of an interesting one. It has the greatest first dot in all of Mage and does all sorts of neat things. And kind of as you go up, you gain the ability to read surface thoughts, then have someone talk to you mentally, as well as then kind of root around more deeply. But also it includes things like uncanny influence, the ability to influence what someone does. At low dots, you get them to do something they would do anyway. At high dots, you'd be like, I'm going to pick up your brain and shake it like an Etch-a-Sketch and rewrite it however you want, which is why I generally don't feel comfortable when a player gets access to Mind 4 or higher, but that's just me. Go Lines and Veils! The Akashiyana hold that seat within the Council of the Nine Mystical Traditions. The next is the Sphere of Prime. Their chair is held by the Celestial Chorus, my second voice. And this is sometimes referred to as meta magic, but this is the ability to manipulate the raw stuff of creation. It helps you detect things like other magical effects that are ongoing, locate nodes, read someone's resonance. It allows you to fuel novel effects and create things that will outlast you simply being there to cause them to persist. This includes making wonders or periaps or talismans or so on. And at higher levels, you have the ability to pull the basic quintessence out of something and flat out destroy it, or at the highest levels, nullify paradox itself, which is pretty baller. Next is the Sphere of Spirit, which is kind of a pattern sphere plus correspondence. It is what allows you to kind of manipulate the stuff of the other worlds. At low levels, it allows you to see spirits. At mid levels, you can start manipulating and adjusting the gauntlet. At higher levels, you can step through it and take friends with you. You also gain influence over spirits. At low levels, you can ask them something nicely. At high levels, you can be like, nope, you're going to do this, which doesn't always work out well because their dice pools can be quite large. And at the highest level, it does an interesting collection of things. You have the ability to command ephemera itself, destroying the spirit matter as it wills. You have the ability to temporarily make a nightfolk not a nightfolk anymore. And that's kind of one of the cool ones. You have the ability to, with great difficulty, manipulate and destroy the stuff of the avatar. You can't really make one, but you can kind of disperse one for a while, as well as step into the furthest reaches of the Umbra that is held by the Kavadi, the Dreamspeakers, on the Council of the Nine. And finally, we have the Sphere of Time. The Sphere of Time at low levels lets you pick up oddities to it. You have a perfect internal clock. You can tell when the appropriate time to do something is. At higher levels, you start gaining the ability to look through the past and future, and then ultimately the ability to manipulate it. This may be just the ability initially to slow it down or speed it up. Later, it has the ability to directly manipulate the time stream to create an effect that will occur at a particular time. And then at the highest level, the ability to travel through time, to step aside from it and move forward and backwards. Informally, this is also the Sphere of Paradox. Anyone who's listening to Mage the Podcast will also know that there are two unlisted spheres. One, the Sphere of Gun, which is available to all mortals and is not to be discounted, as well as the Sphere of Cocaine. But I don't know if this is a family-friendly podcast because it gives you immediate access to time three. So if you're ever wondering how to make your sorcerers a little more potent, there's ways. And those are the spheres.
Well, this is not a family-friendly Twitch show, so you're more than welcome to discuss that as you like. Saturos, would you kindly give us some insight into the history of the creation of magic for mage, the choices made in what has culminated in M20, why these spheres, why these...
A whole lot of thinking on your feet. And I was looking for it earlier, but I don't have it within easy reach. Originally, Stuart and Steve had come up with a magic system that was along these lines, but was more similar to a kind of an advanced thaumaturgy, as in Vampire the Masquerade, but had not actually been playtested. As Andrew Greenberg was talking about this past weekend at the Ice and Dice convention, that system got thrown out. This was before I was hired. That system was thrown out and tossed to Andrew and Travis Williams, who essentially, with, as I understand, some input from Sam Chupp and Stuart, threw the system together from a combination of off-the-cuff ideas and some inspiration from Ars Magica, and put that together in roughly 48 hours. It was in the original edition of Mage, was not balanced, was not playtested, and was broken in several places. When Mage first came out, it was go to Gen Con and start talking to people and fielding questions. There was one player in particular who used to call the office questions, because he had a group that was essentially pushing the system in as many different directions as they possibly could. And he would call me to hash it out. And so I nicknamed him the Loophole Fairy, because that's what he would deliver these loopholes that his players found. And so in the Book of Shadows, which I nicknamed Mage 1.5, I set to adjusting and fixing and redefining that system from first edition so that it was both more workable and more consistent. In the course of that, I had brought in the idea that rank one, to make the effects consistent through those five ranks, rank one allows you to perceive the phenomenon. Rank two allows you to make minor adjustments in the phenomenon on manifestations of the phenomenon that already exist. Rank three allows you to start creating the basics of the phenomenon. Rank four allows you to do major manifestations of the phenomenon. Rank five allows you to conjure the phenomenon from nothing, to do major world-changing things with that phenomenon. The ranks at which you were able to conjure the phenomenon from nothing basically started at rank two or three, depending on previously established rules were. But in the course of doing all of that, I also redefined focus, which originally in first edition, focus was something that a mage waved around to explain what they were doing. Over the course of Mage second edition and Mage Sorcerer's Crusade, it was begun redefining focus as the thing that the mage believes and does in order to channel the forces of reality through their paradigm, through their belief system. When I came back to Mage in the Mage 20 edition, I brought that idea into what we had already established with magical practices to redefine focus as paradigm. What do you believe you can do? Practice. how you put your beliefs into action and instruments, the things you employ, physical or otherwise, in order to take that belief, turn it into action, and direct that action toward your goal. Not only did that add a lot of role-playing elements to Mage, but it also closed a major problem that a significant problem that Mage had had in the earlier days, which was, what's stopping me from doing whatever? Well, the thing that's stopping you is, do you believe that's possible? Mm-hmm. So in Mage 20, you have the section of paradigms, and there are a number of different models for reality, belief systems that say, I believe I can do magic because I believe this. Okay, you choose one of those. Now you focus that through practices. Because I believe this, I do this thing. And in doing this thing, I employ these instruments. That's the way magic works in Mage 20. No, your character doesn't believe that she can do magic like this. How does your character believe she is doing the magic? That mm-hmm. cut off a lot of the weirder convolutions of first edition, which had, you know, did things like, I'm using correspondence to conjure a taxi out of nowhere.
That's my go-to, but okay.
Yeah.
What Satyros is making reference to is, interestingly, a change in paradigm across edition on what determines what is required. On one end, you have results-based, which is ultimately, at the end of the day, your sphere requirements are determined by what came out the other end. In the taxi example, it's correspondence because it got you from one place to t'other. The other one is process-based. Which is the kind of an instrumentalist view of, well, you got a taxi, so you need to find that. Maybe you're using mind for that, entropy to see if there's one nearby, or if you're going flat out vulgar, which I don't know why you do this in the first place, but you can, is like high lever matter in life and be like, bam, taxi. The thing that is kind of interesting about this is results-based does sneak back in to a lot of paradigms kind of out of necessity. And I think this is one of the really cool things you get with paradigms and instruments. So for instance, if your character, and there's an aside on this topic in How Do You Do This, called A Bit of Spirit, which basically says, if your character believes that a spirit is aiding them or the agent, do they need spirit? And it kind of has a discussion either way. Chances are if your character is spirit, they're going to have spirit too to empower it anyway. But where I think this becomes really interesting is any paradigm where you feel that all of your magic is just the manifestation of a fundamental force within the universe. So for instance, if you are the forger of God and you believe that your mastery of the materials of creation is how you do through all of your effects, it could make sense that matter is kind of involved in everything you do. If you're a member of the Technocratic Union or you do your effects through other people, do you suddenly need mind 3 and correspondence 4 to coordinate hundreds of people across it? No. So generally my recommendation to storytellers is, any time a sphere would be required to use a practice or an instrument, it's kind of baked in. You don't need command of matter to use your hammer. It's kind of baked into using a hammer. You don't need correspondence, mind, prime, spirit to send out an email to your organization to do an effect. It's baked into your paradigm of or your practice of organization. So there are frequently arguments of results-based versus process-based, but there is this neat little thing where that results-based does kind of get baked in at that practice level.
As How Do You Do That says, and a number of people seem to keep missing that it says this, How Do You Do That book is guidelines for quick and dirty solutions to the problem. They are options. There are a number of people who are like, I think it works like this. Well, then play it like that. Ultimately, right. as I've said repeatedly throughout the Mage 20 line, Mage belongs to Mage players. Run it the way that you want.
And two principles that How Do You Do That kind of introduces is, one, the idea that kind of the way I read it is, frequently there are two sets of sphere requirements for anything, and it determines if you are using it for dramatic effect or with specificity. So if my character merely wants to bring down the fist of the north wind to absolutely destroy a helicopter that's about to take off, and I am going to rip the icy winds of the north and push that down, what I'm really trying to do is destroy a helicopter or something like that. Forces 5, roll your arete, take your dice, do your chances. But if your goal is to kind of summon an icy wind to cow a city to show that you have great control over weather or something like that, that's where the sphere requirements actually kind of start to tick up, where it's like, well, you're really going to need to be have entropy 3 to make sure everything comes together. And that's a lot of force coming out of nowhere. So you're going to need at least prime 2 to power that, John, and a pile of TAS that would be a comfortable retirement at Dewizitep. It is frequently the case that the discovery of what the rule book says requires a little bit of reflection. And as we're sharing, part of this is going to be, hey, at least on my end, in conversation with other fans, how do we try to instantiate what we believe the intent of the author was? There's kind of this idea that any given effect should only have one set of sphere requirements, which I agree with, but I do add the modifier there that is this for dramatic purposes, or does the specificity of how it's instantiated come into play? Shameless plug, Charles Siegel and I did an episode on adjudicating magical effects. Just search Mage the Podcast for that, and that'll give kind of our guidelines. I am generally a crunchy person. I run a lot of one-shots. I want to be crunchy so I can give an accurate depiction of the game and so someone can take it home to their friends and kind of have something like the similar experience. I'm not crunchy because, like, oh no, it's not a game of Mage until I get to bring out my rulers and minifigs. So just kind of to put my cards on the table, there's a certain repeatability that I want to be able to bring forward while also recognizing the importance of making deviations for drama and the enjoyment of the game.
Yeah, it's not a game of Mage until you have Plotinus, the holographic universe, the Tao Te Ching sitting on the table.
And as a designer, I prefer to err on the side of what makes for a good story. And conversely, what keeps people who want to wreck the game from wrecking the game. One of the reasons that the Mage 20 books feature so many rules and so many options is because, one, I wanted to explain process, but also I wanted to give storytellers a toolbox that was as deep as they needed it to be. You can run Mage 20 off the first 5 pages or so of the magic chapter of chapter 10. I set it aside as if you need to run a quick and dirty thing, just here, bang, 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 use these charts, go. If you need to explore all of the different options, here's 60,000 more words to unpack a bunch of options and to describe how those options work. And here's another book, this 95,000 word book of how to get into if you want to conjure a demon prince, elaborate Enochian rituals, and you want to threaten him with this and this and this and this, unless he does this and this and this. Here are all of the processes involved in doing that step by step by step by step. When I personally am running a game, whether it's Mage or anything else, I tend to run very fast and loose. I recognize most people can't do that or don't want to do that. So I give a modular toolbox going, if you want this, then this. If you want this, then this. But you don't have to use all of this.
I think one of the most frequent things you read about any game is, does it bog down in any section of the rules? Traditionally, is combat. And typically when you're trying to, you know, achieve that level of verisimilitude that only HEMA enthusiasts can, you know, really bring to it. And so quick and dirty is a fantastic option and more people should take advantage of that sort of thing. If you are, for example, coming to Mage from a different game, like one that involves subterranean serpents and things like that, you've got a whole list of spells to work with. And the advantage and charm here is that while you do have rotes and so on, you're not bound to any of that. So have at it.
The first question we got was one on how you would emulate the effect where a mage creates a mosquito to capture some of someone's blood. Kind of one observation I noticed from people coming from other systems is Mage, the thing that is a strength of Mage that I don't think a lot of people give it credit for is it sucks at emulation. It doesn't want to be a Jim Butcher novel. It doesn't want to be the particular magic system that's used in a Neil Gaiman novel. It's its own thing. It is, to some extent, postmodern, and that's kind of hard to get away from. But with the thing in this question, it was, how do I get an insect to get someone else's blood? Try and strip an effect down to what its most basic thing is. And that is, get someone's blood sample. And the question could even be, what are you looking to do that for? If you're a biologically inclined character, you could believe that the set of biomarkers is the equivalent of someone's true name. And that gives you essential kind of core access to them if you can get their blood, spittle, semen, bile, whatever, or something like that. So, like, there's a couple of different ways to kind of look at it. One is you could have Chiminage with a mosquito spirit, and suddenly we have spirit as a way to do it, manipulating the mosquitoes to bite someone through creating a stream of carbon dioxide to make someone look particularly appetizing. I would probably require an additional skill in science chemistry or something like that, or science biology or research or something like that to do it. But when we're trying to consider what an effect is, I recommend you try and figure out, at the end of the day, what are we trying to do? One of the things that frequently is an aha moment is when someone plays a mage game with me. I run a lot of one-shots, and someone's like, can I use this, this, and this so that their bullet goes through the candle, covering it in wax, and lighting the guy on fire? I'm like, you can just light the guy on fire. We can, and if you roll good, we can work backwards, and that way it looks narratively cool. But I think we're doing ourselves a disservice when mage gives us a toolbox of result as opposed to a toolbox methods. Like, Bite Beast Clenched Fist is a flavorful way to punch a guy, but at the end of the day, everyone with forces has a cool ass way to punch a guy. And if you want yours to look like a spell from Forgotten Realms, I don't actually know what setting Bitebee's blanked blank necessarily comes from.
Greyhawk.
Greyhawk, Forgotten Realms, or something like that. You have that flexibility. And while I'm going to copy another game as a good starting block, you're not quite encountering Mage on its own terms. And it takes a little bit to get there, and that's fine. We have a 700-page core rulebook. We're the one core rulebook that is like, Exalted, hold my beer.
There's also who is trying to do what. It's true in all of the editions, but it's especially true in Mage 20. Who is trying to do what and why? Because the way that, you know, the way that a medieval blood witch is going to try to do it is not the way that a cyborg is going to try to do it, is not the way that a martial artist kung fu practitioner is going to try to do it, is not the way that a secret agent gadgeteer is going to do it. They're all going to use different methods. By refocusing it, so to speak, from what spheres do I need to do a spell into who am I playing? How do they approach magic? That is, I think, one of the strengths of Mage. Is when I was first interviewing for the job, they had sent me a copy of Mage as it was being edited. They said, what are the things that you like about it? I said, the thing that I love best about it is that Stuart presented magic as an extension of the Mage. Not as a series of combat maneuvers associated with a school of magic, but as an extension of an enlightened person transforming reality. I said, I fucking love that. Nobody had done that before. That idea of magic is the extension of the Mage has always and remains central to my approach to the game.
And kind of to jump off of what Satoru said, one of the nice things about kind of saying, what kind of practitioner are you? That frees up the traditions to be whatever you want them to be. I personally do not like traditions as paradigms. I consider them to be political factions. They are defined by the thing you must overcome to ascend. The Society of Aether demands that you overcome the notion of reductionism or non-compatibility in worldview. The Akashiana requires you to transcend kind of the notion of self. And I like the idea that the Greek Stoic and the Tibetan Buddhist master are kind of see what the other person go and go, yeah. My favorite example of this is you dive into the Euthanatoi, and must we transcend the kind of the notion of the permanent? And suddenly we have Pomegranate Dime, the Knights of Rhadamanthus, the Mad Zimbabwe, all under the same roof because they all agree kind of in this political and notional thing. Now, they frequently will share practices and they will have an area of control. But to me, one of the cool things about Mage is like, you really can't play Vampire without having a clan. You can really play Mage without having that faction thing built in, and that can be a lot of fun. My character is pious and religious, but the Celestial Chorus just kind of seems weird. I believe in intercessory prayer, but when they talk about this one person, that's a little too touchy-feely at the end of the day. And also the fact that they draw everything back to this weird moment of revelation in Egypt, that's kind of kooky. So, whereas in Vampire, you don't really have the option of a character that practices oblivion heavily without of necessity being a La Sombra. So separating those two One, if it's too complicated for you, just get rid of it. I find the traditions useful because they're very powerful archetypes in the same way that like badass class representations can make someone go, yeah, I want to play that. But the moment you don't find what you want, you get to discard them. And that's super fun. So that gets to be mage too.
I like how you put them there as they're the things you have to overcome for ascension. That also sort of fitting in the idea of almost on a meta level, because as players, we're all using the same mechanics for magic as every other player is, that everyone is still doing the exact same damn thing. They're just calling it something different. That it just, yeah, the traditions are just calling it something different. The idea of once you get past all that, it's all just the same thing. Then they're a speed bump on the way to transcendence and a way to get trapped in consensus in a way. The boundaries blur.
There is a tension within M20 about to what degree are people in on the joke. So one of the angles of satire in the game is we all have different trappings for doing fundamentally the same thing. And one of the glorious things that M20 does is it doesn't tell you what a rite is. It doesn't call it wisdom. It is your mage power stat. And that is the most accurate descriptor of it. It is willpower, but for magic. It doesn't tell you that people at a rite 8, 9, and 10 are enlightened in some universal way that was more common in revised. It's like you can have an arite of 7 and still be a doctrinaire son of a gun. And that is up to you. Do you want to have the satirical parodic game where the technocracy and the traditions basically realize they're doing the same thing, but they have different trappings and there's a sense of ego done? Or do you really want to have that coming to terms with postmodernist games? If you want a little bit of a framework, revised introduced ones with the idea of open closed paradigms and kind of indicating how a person viewed other people's magic. Is my magic primus inter partes? Is it the first among equals? Is it just what I'm doing? Is it a case of, I really don't know what that person is doing? I recognize that it works, but that's something else. That is a whole other play space that the game gives you.
Yeah, it's me trying to handle techno magic up until M20. Okay. Do you guys want to give this a whirl, see how Wheel of Paradigms goes?
Sure.
We'll just poke around, have some fun with it, and if it crashes and burns, then we'll keep talking mage. I'm going to start by giving the first effect because I was asked to do this one, and this one is for Satyros. I'm going to spin the wheel first so you can get your paradigm, and then I'm going to tell you what the effect is, you know, for dramatic buildup. Bring back the golden age is your paradigm. Oh, it doesn't quite show there.
I love it. Oh, okay. That's fun.
So it's bring back the golden age. And the effect proposition comes from Travis Legg, who would like you to turn a lawn chair into a vampire.
Of course he would. For those who aren't familiar, the vampiric lawn chair is a long-standing inside joke in Mage. It's one of the gifts of the Loophole Fairy, and I've been lampshading it and parodying it through the line for the last 29 years.
But traditionally, it's a vampire into a lawn chair.
Yes.
Yes. And here we're doing the reverse. He'd like you to make a vampire out of a lawn chair.
Oh, okay. You're turning a lawn chair into a vampire. That's cute. Terry, do you want me to handle this, or do you want to handle this, or shall we both handle this?
I'm good either way. This one, I think, has a few different approaches to it. The Bring Back the Golden Age as a paradigm basically said that there was a period of time where the god or the gods reigned in glory, people held a valued place below them, gained wisdom through submission, and we have forgotten that the gods are gone and you're attempting to reestablish it. So Bring Back the Golden Age to me would harken back to a character who believed that the Golden Age was broken when the gauntlet rose. And when I think vampire, I think something like a member of the Hungry Dead. So my interpretation for this is I can't make a true vampire. So one of the kind of things that Mage does is it doesn't let you shit on the other lines. You don't get to break someone's connection to Gaia. You don't get to reverse the curse of Cain unless you're Moses Ben Maimon in that one Dark Ages supplement who rolled more successes than God, which I think is cool. You get to do it once and you're an NPC. Mages don't get to waltz into Arcadia. We don't get to just suck pathos out of a wraith. Every line gets to do the cool thing that lets it be special. Like, yeah, you play the guitar, but it's a bass solo right now. Let the bass player have the bass solo.
Tell that to the guitarists.
Yeah. And that's the problem. So that's and mage sometimes is like the Moog synthesizer where it can seemingly do everything, and you're like, no, just let Jimmy have the drum solo now. So to me, my interpretation of that is you are almost creating something like a familiar. You could be a postmodern mage who has this kind of paradigm that views that the Golden Age, we are so far from it that the character focuses on Baudrillard's simulation and simulacrum, and has heard through the game Oracle the Wizening that there is this meme that they are trying to invert. This is a inclusion of mage in the world of mage, which I think is a primer in Book of Secrets, and has read this and is trying to do kind of a notional inversion. So they are using this as a way of creating a familiar, which is intrinsically going to be Spirit 3. They are using Matter 3 to do the reshaping. Once the spirit is there, they need to establish a connection that allows them to transmute human blood or something like it into quintessence that would power them, which is going to be an ongoing Prime 3 effect, as well as Mind 3 to communicate with their familiar. So they are a vampire in the sense that they must continually consume human blood to be able to maintain their form as a familiar. If you use the formal systems for familiar, now they have the ability to maybe consume quintessence, and you get all the fun stuff that came in Gods and Monsters, which is mostly monsters, which is good. Sadly, this is one of my criticisms in that book. Satyrus refused to give us stats for Jesus, you coward. So...
but I did say that Godhead characters can put out manifestations, and I did give rough stats for manifestations.
I want baby Jesus stats, okay? It's that simple. Anyway.
Terry wants Jesus stats.
So the practice...
$2 a pop.
Yeah. The paradigm is bring back the Golden Age in this postmodern sense. The practice is gutter magic. So this person has assembled a whole bunch of blood transfusion bags in a circle in an area that is associated with chronic intravenous drug use. They may even get some of those people to participate in it, and kind of that dearth of vital life is how they draw the attention of a jagling or a gaffling to become their familiar. And that's one way to approach the lawn chair into a vampire, where the lawn chair kind of becomes the ambulatory body of this blood-sucking companion creature that kind of represents stasis and a lack of life.
Dude, I want to play mage with you.
Gladly.
I step out of the game now.
I've done it once or twice.
That was very cool. Now, hold on. Does it actually not transmute into a vampire then? But it is symbolically a vampire.
It is symbolically. It is notionally a vampire. Uh-huh. One of the things that mage does is, like for instance, in Gods and Monsters, we get the, I apologize, I don't know how to pronounce it, but like for instance, the hopping vampires, you have the Wanga. There's a lot of cultures that have a thing that consume a thing if you don't watch out for it. And we tend to kind of call those vampires. If someone wanted to be a canine vampire, that's one of the cases where I'd simply say either no or story arc. Maybe with enough successes in entropy, I would be able to adjust the skeins of fate to move the mark of Cain. But to have a paradigm that even has an idea of what the curse of Cain could be is hard. So during character creation, one of the things I do is I say, what does your character think is impossible? For instance, there are a lot of pagan traditions that don't have a notion of resurrection. Like, what do you mean, go the other way? That's not a thing. And likewise, teleportation may not be a thing that your paradigm can do, and so on. And you can kind of get around it where you're making a copy that is awfully similar to this person. But I think it is perfectly reasonable during character creation to say, I don't think my character can do this. And not just in a systematic sense, but that magic cannot do this as I understand it. And some of the areas of growth, some of the plot beats you can have is, how does your character come to terms with seeing someone else do that? And this is super fun in technocratic games, where you're like, wow, I didn't think that someone could directly interface with noetic forces without a Campbell field condenser. What do I do with that now? And throughout the editions, the degree to which the technocracy understands what's really going on has very much varied. But one of the things that's been nice, at least across second edition forward, is they are smart enough to realize they don't know how to do things, and they are dumb enough to think that if they just try hard enough, they themselves can do it. And that's the glory of being a technocrat. So stay in school, kids.
True heroes. Okay.
And Terry just touched on another thing that a lot of people don't think about when they're metagaming is the characters in the World of Darkness do not have copies of each other's games. In Gods and Monsters, it shows vampires, werewolves, and so forth from the perspective of the way a mage would view them, rather than the way that a person who has read Vampire the Masquerade would view them. You know, can you turn a lawn chair into a canine? Of course not. A mage character is not even going to know what the fuck a canine is. Sure, they may have heard this weird rumor that the vampires believe they're descended from the, you know, from Cain, and that they have these odd families, and they have these family crests, and vampires of this kind seem to be at war with vampires of this kind, and they refer to this as the Jihad or something, but they're not going to have the slightest idea what the curse of Cain is, because that's not part of their world.
It took me a little while in the beginning, I think, to sort of grasp this. I think one of the easy ways, I think, to see that the games are not meant to raw be crossover, not only should the characters not know or care about these mythologies of the other game lines, but when, you know, you say something's maybe underpowered because a rank one guru can't take down an Ancilla vampire, but the vampires keep talking about how terrifying all the guru are. Well, the vampires are talking about how terrifying the lupines are, who are in the bestiary, in the, well, quote unquote bestiary, in the back of the vampire book, and who are using vampire stats and rules because it's stripped down to just what is needed for vampire to have werewolves. So the settings, the mythologies of them are also not specifically intended fully for a crossover. There are some areas where it's similar, like werewolf and mages, cosmologies with the triad and so on, but it doesn't work that way.
It keeps them much more mysterious and evocative, too. My friend, the Toreador Ancillae, is a whole lot less intimidating than that strange undead thing that thinks it's an artist and it creates paintings with blood. That's a much more interesting idea, I think. I'm a big believer in preserving mystique.
One of the things that a storyteller can do to improve their games is literally just describe the sensory experience that is incurring as opposed to necessarily the results. A cataclysm of ethereal sparks that seem to be emerging from beneath the fingernails of this other person who recently seemingly took a hit off of what appears to be an electric oboe and now seems to have their head turning all the way around. Now, the cool thing about that is entirely atmospheric, at least at my table. That person doesn't need spheres to do that. Like, until the game world changes in some way, who cares? But just kind of focusing on that. There's a line in the maybe Orphan Survival Guide. One of the characters in Inworld says, "The back of my neck lit up and my mouth tasted like blood and chocolate. It was the unmistakable sign of magic." And just like, and you're like, oh wow, now I know how this person kind of experiences that. And the more we can point at that, the more rich it is, and the easier it is to like not do the Toreador thing, but to just have like six or seven facts about them where they're wearing a immaculate 1971 Armani suit that looks like it has been hit with hydrogen peroxide a dozen times to remove what you're not entirely sure. You're immediately caught by the fact that throughout this conversation, their chest has not risen but once. Focus on the sensory experiences. That is outside of scope, but Terry's recommendation if you're storytelling.
There's a whole section about that in the storytelling chapter of Mage 20. And it's one of the reasons why there is so much emphasis in the Mage books I've worked on, fluff, on flavor fiction, and especially in Mage 20 on the sensory details of what the characters are experiencing or seeing, rather than, and then he used his forces cannon against the Cthulhoid monster summoned by the Nefandi instead of a bizarre tentacled thing in a cloud of smoke. And that, again, it's much more interesting and much more fun that way, I think.
Say you describe something like that, a situation like that, and you've got players who see that and go, cool, I want to do that. But do you ever worry about consistency or, you know, well, if they can do that, why couldn't they do this, et cetera? Or is that one of those points where you just sit there and go, you know what, rules or guidelines, it was really cool that they could do that. That's about the only thing they can do in that area, or they can do it that one time, or they can only do that thing.
You kind of say something interesting, level of power that something has suggested. The ability to turn skin flakes into sparks and conflagrate them is pretty easy, a conjunctional effect across a number of spheres. Like, subtly forging a new psyche is going to be invisible to almost the entire world, but is Mind 5 creating a new node? So it is interesting in Mage where almost Arete kind of determines how flashy you can be, the sheer number of successes, whereas Sphere level, not necessarily. Like, if I create a new material with Matter 5 that has the ability to dissolve the color pink, or something like that, that's not necessarily going to be showy unless I would like it to be. But to the question, I generally don't require anything that is atmospheric. Once the person says I'm doing this to cow the crowd, then it is instrumental and I am going to require those spheres. And that does create an inconsistency from the vantage of the people in the world. And that is fine. The question is, Mage is not a physics engine. And the more people want it to be that, the faster it breaks. Sadaros has created sphere requirements in some cases to, again, protect players from storytellers who don't quite have a fully enumerated idea of how they want magic to work in the world. And an easy way to do that is kind of increase sphere requirements, and then it kind of goes from there. But I am perfectly comfortable saying this is instrumental and requires this. This is just you looking cool. That is entirely fine. Like, if the tendrils of mind control that I send out to my minions create a streak of fire across the sky, am I going to require prime enforces for that? No, it looks badass though. The moment I want to use the same effect to light their heads on fire, now I'm requiring forces and correspondence and prime to do that. And that is something I try and bring up early in the game with the players when kind of saying, these are the guidelines I'm going to use to adjudicate. In a lot of games, you have the idea of rulings, not rules, where you try and create an internal set of consistent rules and try and explain your logic. And if you are caught in a corner, you can perfectly say, hey, I really think that's going to break the narrative right now. I think I may have made a mistake in the other one. Do you feel that that's reasonable? And it could be something where you're like, hey, that you can kind of have meta narrative negotiation where you say, this plot corner has occurred. I'm perfectly fine giving you 3 experience points for it. Invisible Sun and a number of the Monte Cook games have the idea of GM intrusions where it's like, nope, not how it works, but I'm going to give you a very useful in-game resources in X-Trade. So now you get to trade off the inconsistency with the fact that it's like, but I'm giving you a thing. I'm not just screwing you over. So there are any number of ways of dealing with it. And I am perfectly comfortable embracing that type of seeming inconsistency.
So 2 things there. One, rulings, not rules, and protecting players from the GM, suggesting an antagonist or antagonistic relationship. Does this mean Mage is an OSR game?
Oh, some people do play it that way.
Twitter.
Or protecting the storyteller from the players.
Yes.
As I was saying earlier, was how I learned where a lot of the loopholes were. In addition to all of that, life itself in reality is not consistent.
Yes.
You can slap somebody in the face and they will fall down and hit the ground in just such a way that they die of a brain hemorrhage. Or you can shoot somebody 10 times at point blank range with a 9mm and they'll keep coming. Real life is not consistent. I know from my own experience, if you add adrenaline to a situation, you'll shrug off shit that you shouldn't be able to. Reality does not follow consistent rules. That's one of the things that drives scientists up the wall. Just keep trying to reduce reality to predictable mathematical. And that's one of the things I've satirized with the technocracy. Certain people keep trying to reduce reality to predictable mathematical physical patterns. It just doesn't work.
Just to kind of take the question, do I consider Mage to be adversarial? No. There is an interpretation of the game, and this is perfectly valid, that I have set up a world that works under its own narrative physics that obey the rules of the game. You were introduced as agents into the story. I will follow this book so you have reliable outcomes and you get to run around in it like we are very crappy GPUs. I personally don't find that interesting. But like, for instance, if we were sitting down to play Monopoly or something like that, and someone's like, no, I don't think you should get the property just because you paid, because you landed on it and you paid it. That's no fun. Like, kind of at a critical point, you're not playing Monopoly at this point. So I get the idea that you want there to be a system of rules that guide play. And in a game like this, there is always, if you don't want to be a GM fiat person, there is always the ability to say, Yeah, throw some dice. I'm generally in the say yes or throw some dice camp. Mm-hmm. So it is not necessarily adversarial.
Solid camp to be in. Yeah.
I do think the World of Darkness has, until Victorian Mage, World of Darkness has no player mechanics. Everything is a character mechanic. There are no rewrite pools. There are no redo buttons. Everything comes from your character as an agent in the world. Now, you as a player get to choose a different stance or get to negotiate with the storyteller, but there are no explicit mechanics. There isn't a momentum pool. When I play a game of Scion, the Scions don't know there's a momentum pool, but my character kind of has an idea of how much they have left in the tank. That's kind of willpower. They're not aware that they have a willpower of 6. So the byproduct of that is we have to switch suddenly between this crunchy in-world way of viewing this and kind of the narrative negotiation of a bunch of people coming up with a story together, because the magic of magic is when we get people together to tell stories that is meaningful to them through the tools that we ourselves do not have in our day-to-day lives. I mean, role-playing, hooray! We get to live out other lives in a world that does not exist. People are generally uncomfortable jumping to that other system where you and I negotiate and I say, hey, I think it would be appropriate if I know this person is an archmaster. I really want to get one shot off at them. They can blow my leg off, but my character is going to feel so great knowing that they grabbed a piece of their robe. There's no formal system for that. And the old World of Darkness just isn't a game that has that. If I pull out my copy of Hillfolk, I do that by sliding my GM a narrative token and say, this is how this scene unrolls. Or in Fiasco, I set up the game to say, I get to choose how this scene comes out, but you get to set up how it is. So it is hard when we want to try and create a specific story, but there is a system there if we don't choose to kind of switch to that other thing. So I do not think it is adversarial. It can be adversarial if a storyteller has a story forgetting the players or agents.
Yes.
One way of framing the game is by saying that we are all different types of players. I hate being a character. It's why I storytell. I don't like just kind of being stuck in one thing. I much prefer to switch it and say, we are all storytellers, but Satyros happens to be specializing in Atropos, and Simon happens to be specializing in Nile or something like that. And that gives the players the freedom to say, oh, I think it would be really cool if the bed and breakfast we were actually in is a technocracy front. Can that be the case? Like, and I don't know any number of times where a character has started sniffing up a particular thing and hey, there's suddenly plot there. So I don't think it is adversarial unless a storyteller walks in with a particular story or the players walk in with a particular way that the game needs to be done. Mage simply can't undergo that kind of scrutiny. OSR games can, because there's only so many things that you can do. On the other end of the spectrum, Powered by the Apocalypse games do the same thing, where they channel everything into basic ways to interact with the world. Rulings, not rules, is the idea that you take the game and the world as presented and kind of make extensions that you feel make sense. You brought up how do you do that? How do you do that is kind of a maximal interpretation. It is a way to run magic such that you are less likely to get into a weird corner. Where you're like, oh, but if you view it from this, and then so, oh, dink, that's annoying. But if your game isn't going to hit a Rite 4-5 or Sphere level 4-5, you can go remarkably far doing things off the cuff. So just to kind of bring it back to those original claims,
I'll spin it. We'll get the paradigm, and then I'm going to tell you what the effect is. It's very cool, and I haven't quite wrapped my head around all of it just yet. That's World of Gods and Monsters. So the effect that was suggested was to recreate the never been born effect from It's a Wonderful Life. This is, spawns from a demon, the descent effect on person. It's not so much that it removes someone from existence entirely. The person, the target, still exists, but no one remembers them, and all evidence that they did exist is ignored. So they're just sort of a free agent, loose cannon flying around in the World of Darkness here.
So in a World of Gods and Monsters, I would think that the practitioner is probably going, okay, so what god or spirits do I call upon to present this person with a temporary experience of doing the
It's a Wonderful Life?
I would establish which entity I was trying to contact, set up a ritual, say if I'm going to conjure up an angel of forgetfulness or an angel of an alternate life. Call upon that entity, maybe setting out photo albums, some sort of a very complex diagram, or maybe a very, very simple diagram with a piece missing, and maybe a photo album where the photos have been turned upside down. So definitely be saying gutter magic in that case, connecting that with a person through writing the subject's name down on a piece of paper, the names of several people that that person knows, drawing lines to them and then erasing the line and then erasing part of the lines, calling upon the entity and telling the entity, I want to have so-and-so, you know, subject of the spell, experience what it would be like if they had never been born. Sphere-wise, that would probably be spirit 3, maybe spirit 4, if you're going to command the spirit to do that. Commanding power spirits that powerful is not generally a very good idea. So essentially spirit 3, talk to the spirit, offer the spirit something that the spirit wants, find out what it wants. Say, okay, if you do this, then I will give you this. And then have the spirit walk that person through an alternate timeline in which they do not exist and cannot interact with the rest of the world. If you're going to try to temporarily wipe out that person's existence, then you're dealing with, you know, mind 5, correspondence 5, spirit 3, time 4 or 5. And a whole lot of successes. I think it would be a whole lot easier to just go, hey, spirit, can you take them through this thing and then do something, get the spirit to do something that the mage themselves would not have the power to do.
You can't do it, so get someone else who can.
Exactly. I mean, that's what you conjure demons for in the first place.
Right.
Angels, other entities, and so forth. You know, if you're going to work with entities, work with an entity that can do things you can't.
No, so there you got a hard way of doing it and the easier, more practical way of doing it, suggesting that you don't need to have necessarily the archmage level capacity to pull these things off. You can have a little less. Terry, any thoughts on that breakdown or analysis?
Sure. One of the things I like about the world of gods and monsters is, philosophically, I personally am an absurdist. I do not believe that there is meaning in the universe, but trying to pursue meaning gives us something that really looks like meaning, especially if it's with friends and it ends with, like, ice cream. So Albert Camus wrote my original kind of manual for living, which is a weird thing to say out loud. And A World of Gods and Monsters is kind of the dark side.
You heard it here first.
Yeah. Is kind of the dark side of existential philosophy. There is nothing out there. So to me, this character who was doing this effect would go on a psychic journey following and tailing this person that they wanted to pursue, picking up all the elements that they thought defined them, and then finding out how it's just a series of coincidences, oddities, and happenstance that has created them. It could be entirely a mathematical view of things. This could be almost a view of, this is how you influence the Akashic record or something like that, that we are but creatures of the skein of fate. Sphere-wise, the most elegant way to do that to me is Entropy 5. You are breaking down the concept of the person. This is kind of slightly inverting what Entropy 5 does. Normally, Entropy 5 is breaking down a person's idea, whereas this is temporarily breaking it down for everyone else. You would be kind of assaulting their little part of a pattern of life, their little thing of the Tellurian. So suddenly maybe that requires Mind 2 to kind of syndicate that out and Prime 2 to power it and correspondence, technically 5, because it's always going to be defined as what the minimum thing is going to be. The other way to do it would be just kind of Forces 3, Correspondence 3. Literally, you are garbling their appearance. Another fun one would be Spirit 4, Entropy 4, Life 3, where you actually just kind of shove them into an Everett volume. Where you're literally, so Everett volumes are the technocratic term for mirror zones, which are areas floating around in the Umbra, which are kind of alternate realities, but they're not quite full. We get the idea that our reality, or at least our reality in Mage, is kind of the special one. It's not like there's an infinite multiverse, because Mage quickly realized that going that way is lame. There's infinite,
crime.
Yeah, there's infinite possibility, but it's all kind of in one spot. The Tellurian and the Tapestry are pretty big, though. And you would basically shove someone into that, find the Everett volume that contains them not having existed, and shove them into it. That very much inverts it. It doesn't kind of do it for a scene. That would be the story scale version of it. But there's a very simple way with Mind and Forces, if you're just trying to get to something that where that person is not interpreted, appropriately, or people literally can't make out what they're saying, or it constantly messes up their name. Mind and Forces, both at level 3, can do wonderful jobs creating those kind of illusions. The tricky thing about Mage is there are no metaphysical truths, except for the game system. And even that is not a metaphysical truth, because it depends on your table. So Mage frequently lacks a defined set of cosmic MacGuffins. So, like, there are no Infinity Stones in Mage, because, like, that would posit a true type of magic that were paradigm independent, that were recognized by everyone. And that's not Mage anymore. Right. As time goes on, like, even things like nodes became even more context dependent. Satoros's character could throw a rock concert for 2,000 people, and my syndicate member might get just kind of an inkling that primal utility is flowing around, but I can't look at that conflux or wellspring and go, ha, magic juice. So it becomes kind of difficult to do those things that I would kind of call plot level events, where, right. For instance, could I convince Clotho the Spinner to unweave the skein, or Lachesis to change the allotment, or Atropos to undo it? Yeah, but that's you're using magic to have that plot event occur. Magic isn't causing the spirit to do it. And as Satoro said, Spirit 4 lets you challenge the spirit. It doesn't mean you're going to succeed. You need dice for days on that. And Mage's power stat increases real slow.
This alludes to something that's incredibly important when you're using Mage magic, is the number of successes you need to do things. To do simple, easy things, that's, you know, one success, two successes maybe. To do really huge, world-changing things, 10 successes, 15 successes, 20 successes, that's what rituals are for. The difficulty that you need to overcome depends a lot on how are you trying to do it. Are you trying to do something really big and showy in a vulgar manner that's going to stir up a whole bunch of reality? Or are you doing slow, steady, subtle things? That also affects how these things are being done. How are you doing it? What are you trying to do, and how are you trying to do it?
Your character, who has absolutely no charisma, social skills whatsoever, is trying to persuade one of the fates to alter destiny here. Like, that is what you want? Yeah. Roll for it.
The next question here was how to emulate a number of superhero powers.
Yeah, Forces 3, Life 3, that's a pretty easy one. Prime, if you want to trap it to the pattern for an extended period. The one that I think is the most fascinating here, interestingly, and brings up to your crossover question, is spread sunlight through the area. Because Mage across its history has given 4 different answers to what is sunlight. In some cases, it is the emanation of Helios. Forces cannot recreate that. There was kind of an idea introduced in early Mage that came up probably precisely 3 times, because all the best Mage references, you just kind of get these little fleeting steps. You're like, wait, what? It was the idea that basically stars just kind of shoot off quintessence. And at that point, again, it's not just a Forces thing. And that was kind of an idea that was introduced with the Copernicus research statement, that it's like these massive quintessence harvesters. And then you're like, are they harvesting quintessence from a star? Or is it just the sheer sense of wonder that the entire Void Engineers get from the fact that they're like, we have Dyson Sphere, Sphere big, Sun strong. There's so many different ways to take it. And this is one of those awesome ones where it's like, yeah, what is sunlight? And that's some Meiji bullshit, to use the technical term. And I am entirely fine with it. And kind of the answer to everything is, if you want it to be true sunlight, it's because you need to break something, in which case you just kind of add Prime 3 to make it aggravated. But still, I think that is one of those fun ones that can get surprisingly detailed. And I think there's a little aside in how do you do that on So Sunlight, yep. And brings up that question, because at a critical point when we start interfacing with other quote-unquote metaphysical truths in the terms of the Garu or Kainites or whatever, we actually get to have the entire experience of Mage the Ascension as a secret history run very quickly, where it's like, okay, there are these things out there. What do I make sense of them? How do I acquire more information? How do I integrate that into my paradigm? And then how do I see it? Because no matter what you do, you can't force the vampire to be something else, but it may just not come across the same way to you. So the question of, so sunlight is one of those, I think, subtle, surprisingly fun little questions that a game group gets to answer.
You can definitely have fun with technocrats who have got a very reductionist view of what sunlight is, trying to affect a vampire, and then they conjure what they think sunlight is, but doesn't affect the vampire because the vampire is affected by the metaphysical power of God.
As delivered through the sunlight.
Delivered through the sunlight. And what the vampire is actually harmed by is a curse bestowed by their god.
And to some extent, if my particle acceleration cannon is doing aggravated damage to the technocrat, it very much can get to a very similar place.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep. It could also why is that? That sunlight has nothing of God in it. No, but it has accelerated particles.
Yes.
Take that, Dracula.
Our photons are faster. Take that, Einstein. We're the technocracy. We're about coulda, not shoulda.
Yep.
Good motto there.
The target appears less likable, cute, and attractive. Yes. But mm-hmm. in what way? How do you define those things? And again, what's your paradigm?
Just on the edge of everything is an illusion, prison, or mistake. Actually, it seems much easier to fit into this like perception-based spell.
You could interpret that as just you've changed the illusion, or mm-hmm. you know, of course, appearance and attractiveness are illusory to begin with. So all we've done is just adjust the way that people perceive the illusion. And the question is the practitioner changing the way the people view the subject of the spell, or are they changing the way the subject thinks they are being perceived?
I picked that one from the Ars Magica book, Magi of Hermes, from one of the characters who is very family-based and would use it on his own family for reasons. But it also seemed like an interesting one to go with. Everything is data, still going to work.
Everything is data, will work. I mean, the obvious choice there would simply be using uncanny influence through mind, just having people perceive, adjusting either the subject mind to having them feel less attractive, because that's going to influence the way people perceive them. Anyway, if a person feels unattractive, they're going to be perceived as unattractive by other people. If you're using a large-scale mind effect to control other people to think that somebody who would normally be perceived as attractive is suddenly unattractive, then that would be just a larger mind three. Actually, really, just either they feel unattractive, so that's mind two, and their perception of how they're perceived, or, you know, a large scale trying to influence a whole bunch of people to see that person as unattractive is still mind too. It's just the way who you cast. Do you cast it on all those people, or do you cast it on that person? And then you could lock an effect. If for instance, what you're doing is casting this spell on Joe over there, and Joe, wherever Joe goes, people are going to perceive him as unattractive, then that you have to lock the effect with life three, because you are attaching the effect to Joe's pattern, so that wherever Joe goes, even if he leaves your presence, he's still going to be perceived as unattractive. So that would be, you know, mind two, life three, life three, mind two, and then just lasting for however long the spell, whatever the duration the spell lasts, is based on your successes. Now, in terms of the character, what the character is doing, if you have a hermetic wizard who's going to curse, I curse you in the name of Azrael, then, you know, you work up this whole spell thing with maybe a very detailed Vitruvian drawing of the subject, or maybe taking a photograph and attaching that and calling upon this spirit, that spirit, that spirit, that spirit to curse this person for however long. Or alternately, you could just, you know, do the dude, people really, really hate you, saying an insulting thing in such a cutting way that the person actually believes it and absorbs that into themselves. Literally, in the case of the game, they're absorbing their effect in there, where you just say, dude, you're a real asshole, and you really need to look at yourself in the mirror, because that's a really ugly reflection and everybody knows it. That right there is casting a spell.
Yeah. Oh, very Mean Girls.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Again, to break it down into systems terms, you'd be using vocalization, eye contact, and social domination, the instruments of those things. And practice-wise, that would probably be dominion practice. And basically, what you're doing is playing mind games with your subject.
Right, nasty stuff.
Yep. And that's one of the things that I love about Mage, especially with the change, literally the change in focus in 20th anniversary, is you can do any number of things, just redefining how you're doing it. You could just do it through an email. Mm-hmm. You could do that through a blog post. I mean, and you see that play out in real life all the time, people who get cyberbullied. You could channel that through internet activity, social domination through internet activity, and cyberbully the person into feeling that they are going to be perceived as unattractive.
Do you ever find or suggest that they just do it mundanely?
Oh, you can always do it mundanely.
Mages
will argue how much of it is mundane. Again, like I said, cyberbullying somebody, is that magic?
Yes.
Well, the Nefandi are really good at cyberbullying people through magic, but mm-hmm. is it magic?
Kind of one of the things baked into Mage, and I don't know if this was intended or not, but it was one of those weird like lightning bolt moments, is every other game seemingly in the old World of Darkness is it's going to be downsheet attribute plus upsheet attribute to generate a dice pool. Mage doesn't do that, but it does do this other thing that's pretty effing powerful. Trait rolls informed by magic, and magic informed by trait rolls. Trait I just say is a substitute for attribute and ability, because sometimes it's a attribute and a background, or a background and something. It got a little bit more fun in M20, where it's like, nah, you roll these things together, why the heck not? The greatest rule of all time, introduced in the original Void Engineers.
Yeah, while I'm editing things, I wanted to say virtual add-ups, not Void Engineers, my bad.
Where you roll computer plus avatar during a core war, and you're like, yeah, we don't know what we're doing. But I mean, the superpower of mages is it's like you're kind of using your magic to make your words preternaturally effective. At the end of the day, you're still doing a manipulation plus subterfuge or empathy or whatever, but you've got this magic effect that suddenly makes it easier. And kind of the things I do at my table are, one, you can have that difficulty change. Another thing you can do is kind of shift the outcome, where it's probably not possible to write a letter so scathing that somebody like walks into the Delaware, really. But if you got some magical oomph behind it, suddenly the results shifts two ways. And now your success is an extraordinary success. Your failure is just comes out blank. And that's kind of one of the superpowers. And like for the first couple editions of Mage, and for like Mage across a lot of different time periods, that's really the superpower of the technocracy. Like, if you're rolling intelligence plus finance to try and make money, having a -2 difficulty modifier puts you ahead of the rest of the market. So over large scales, over repetitions, over centuries, you get to do these subtle changes that can really shift the odds in your favor. It doesn't look as magical, but it does have the system output of this bog standard mortal. Sure, they have slightly more dots than a regular human. Mages are cut from sterner stuff. Like, there's a reason we have willpower 5. Thank you very much. We're the cool kids. And I always wanted to do a tropen version of the Syndicate having discovered the secret of cosmic horror and going, oh, that's stupid. It's actually just mimetic. And now they built like little bits of Azathoth and Cthulhu into horror franchises. So literally it activates the terror matrix built into reality to have better box office returns. And I really, if a mage is going to die to being shot, I think they should look at Azathoth and say, I'm not scared, you twat. With a British accent, it makes everything better. Again, the power of mages. Yeah, they can die from being shot. Again, the sphere of gun is not to be trifled with, but we get to bring a little bit of magic to everything, and that can really just kind of tilt it. And when you do something like that, the botches tend to be less injurious, because you're like, well, okay, I botched writing an email. What's the thing that really went wrong there? Like, does your computer blob? And we can talk about Terry's greater theory of the five types of botches or whatever. But the thing not to be trifled with is the fact that abilities can help magic and magic can help abilities. And for a prepared mage, that can make a world of difference and make people go, was that actually magic? I don't know.
Right. Well, I guess that's one of those areas where it helps the distinguishing with vulgar and coincidental. We've got one final effect in here, which is actually a nice one to put in, because it's the one that I started on with the show and discussed throughout each of the traditions, is the idea of how do you get a teacup off of a telephone pole? Nice and simple effect.
I hope it's one-way trip to oblivion, and then you can just use a Werner Herzog voice and be like, the notion that the teacup sits upon it depends on a notion of space and place, that is an artificial constraint we have placed on a cosmos that cares not for us.
I wanted to say, screw mechanistic cosmos, let's do one-way trip to oblivion now. And it was two away, so if I nudged the wheel a little bit. So we got a mechanistic cosmos. So under mechanistic cosmos, and via whatever instruments, practices, what have you, you want. How do you get a teacup off a telephone pole?
I just pick up a pebble, figure out the trajectory using my mathematical calculations, predict trajectory, toss the pebble, knock the teacup off. And that could be either entropy 2 or forces 2.
Oh, and then catch it. Okay, I was going to say, make sure it doesn't break.
Yep. I've just adjusted the probability that I will hit the teacup and that the teacup will not break when I hit it and that I will catch the teacup. And that's just a matter of I have mechanistically plotted out the trajectory of that and I have calculated out exactly what the precise amount of force necessary to get it from there to get that down to there and for me to place my hand here.
Excellent.
Using something like Crazy Wisdom, my character would create a set of objects placed in a nearby road, forcing vehicles to swerve. The kind of the swerving action of this would kind of set up a certain resonance within the telephone pole that after maybe 20 or 30 seconds of this, the pole kind of starts waving back and forth. And again, as we know, if the energy just keeps building up, the telephone pole is eventually going to break. It kind of snaps and just kind of teeters over at that maximum bend back point and just kind of lands to the ground. The actual instrument that is being done is this is kind of a ritual and correspondence thing in terms of setting up the location of things. Practice is going to be Crazy Wisdom. The mechanistic cosmos, chaos is an illusion. There are a set of interactions, a deeper, more beautiful symmetry that we do not have immediate access to. But as a teacup-omancer, my character, spending any number of times in the spire of children's toys in the High Umbra, or alternatively going to the elemental court of porcelain, has figured out those deep symmetries, the ways in which teacup kind of suffuses reality. If I want to go next level, my character's avatar is Bertrand Russell. And in this case, since you're literally just moving a teacup, I would perfectly be fine if this is an overly complicated way of just doing correspondence too and just being like, yoink, moving the small object. Or if we literally want to destroy the pole, it would be forces 3 and entropy 3 to kind of have everything fall together as I want. Forces 2, entropy 3 would probably do it. Then you get to use Mage's structured and durability rule, which I find fascinating because Werewolf is the game where you're constantly ripping doors off of hinges and they really don't have rules for ripping doors off of hinges. And Mage is like, you know what's really weak? Mages. You know what we should have rules for? Not letting you turn a Sherman tank into a cloud of bees. And that's how Mage delivers, kids. Structure and durability. Just putting that out there. But again, it's entirely optional.
Thank you.
Sure.
Also, nice callback to Ink. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. You've never seen Ink?
I've seen almost none of the inspirations for Mage.
Okay.
Mechanistic cosmos, like almost all the paradigms, my one note is, by definition, they have to have a short title, but they are all much bigger than their name kind of establishes. Like, so a mechanistic cosmos can include all of Gnosticism or anything with the notion of a divine watchmaker, not just believing that the cosmos is kind of a physics engine. Like anything, like a lot of things that have an idea of sympathy also fit into a mechanistic cosmos. There are deeper symmetries that are not available. So my character could rub their teacup and use that kind of as their focus of correspondence to set up a sympathetic connection with that other teacup and try and join those two teacups together on a much deeper level and making the space in between them kind of illusory. Like the one that took me the longest time is Might is Right, which is one of the things that happens is a lot of these are also like philosophical positions or political positions, but like Might is Right is you saying, I am amazing. Cosmos, do what I say. It is not the same thing as what, for instance, a vampire would say when they say Might is Right. Like to some extent, a hermetic character demanding entrance to the city of Pymander and showing their mastery over the self is Might is Right in a basic way. The veneer of that may be highly ritualistic, but they believe that there is a cosmic pecking order and they've done the damn work to move up it. All of these paradigms, at least the ones in the core book, some of the other ones get a little more specialized and to me are kind of more NPC kind of things. They're a lot bigger than we give them kind of first credit for. And many of them will include way more practices than at first we think. So when you see someone write it down, you may want to say, let's come up with three little variants of this. The way I do it at my table is I do tenets, which are basically, how do I go from this is the state of the cosmos to this is why I'm allowed to do magic? So a character believes in intercessory prayer, that I can pray to heal someone. There is a cosmic creator that is benevolent and wishes us to flourish. They have the ability to hear requests. Mages are those who know how to formulate requests in such a way that this being will respond. And that kind of has explained from how I get from this is the state of the universe to why my character is special and can do magic. And then you just practice an instrument on top of that.
Yep, that's a great idea.
Good advice. If there's anything further you wanted to impart or reiterate, reinforce to our audience on sphere magic, use of spheres, conjunction with paradigms, et cetera, that sort of sounds like an answer. But if you've got a second one, either of you, any final thoughts or statements you'd like to make to assist our viewers on working their way through the potentially intimidating, but not all that actually intimidating in the end, sphere magic?
One thing I ask players regularly is what their character makes of another character's magic. It will flesh out the character. It will flesh out the group. It will give an idea of what they can do and what they can't. Whenever they see a kind of a supernatural thing seemingly happen, I kind of break it down into three things. One is you can convey to the character the physical sensations they experience. Then they get to choose affect, which is kind of that initial first line cut of how the body experiences it phenomenologically. And then it goes through the lens of what the character knows and it turns into emotion. I think it is very interesting to give all of the players the same set of physiological responses and saying, okay, as this demon appears, you can feel the rush of balefire over your body, a flame so hot you feel that your soul is chilled. What do you make of that? And one character goes, oh, this person has figured out how to determine thermiontic anti-temperature. This will surely help me advance in the negasphere of forces, where someone else is like, this is proof of why all things outside of reality should be banished eternally. And another person is just kind of hit with the raw, well, don't want to mess with this guy. And I think giving characters an opportunity through the medium of players to respond is going to flesh out your world and give you those kind of sensory and narrative cues that help you with the rules interpretations. The further off we can put that in game, I think the more graceful we can be when we flub it. When you're just like, and you're like, well, I mean, we got some really great narration and some character beats. Who cares if this one role was kind of derp? And that is Terry's recommendation. For more information, listen to Mage the Podcast every other week.
Let's mix that with the plug section too. Cetros?
Magic is what matters. Everything else is set dressing. Magic is what matters. We can spend hours and thousands, tens of thousands of words. Believe me, I know I've done it, hundreds of thousands of words, describing all of the parameters of how to apply that in your game. But ultimately, mage is about what matters to your character, what matters to your mage, and how, by extension, that matters to you.
Awesome. Awesome stuff.
To simplify all of that into how to run the game, check out Mage Made Easy. The Storyteller's Vault from DriveThruRPG, because that takes this whole big 700 page tome and goes basically throughout this, keep this if you want it, keep this if you open, if you want it, direct your magic through the way your character perceives the magic, how they do the magic. But ultimately, like I said, it's what it comes down to. Magic is what matters.
Awesome stuff. Thank you both for coming on. I hope our audience has enjoyed this this discussion. I definitely have. The fact that you're both very delightful people to speak with, it's always a very enlightening conversation. Thank you, everyone, for watching tonight. Thank you, Cetros, and thank you, Terry, for coming on the show.
This has been Mage the Podcast, where if you're going to go walk into shadow, we'll be your flashlight. If you have a way of turning sound into light, just use the flashlight app on your phone, please. This episode was made possible by Sean Gallagher, Orgel of Retrieving DNA by grabbing some hair from that weird hole in barbershop floors. Where does that even go? Ben Bendelow, Orgel of Retrieving DNA by taking advantage of 23andMe data breach. Buck Gregory, Orgel of Retrieving DNA by just being charming and claiming they need it for a school project. Christopher Phillips, Oracle of Retrieving DNA by grabbing their parents' DNA and just running 70 trillion simulations. It's got to be one of them. Guy Stewart, Oracle of Retrieving DNA with the world's first boomerang syringe. Josh Hellerup, Oracle of Retrieving DNA using Canadian waterboarding, which uses maple syrup and is quite unpleasant. Puka G, Oracle of Retrieving DNA by swabbing a greased light pole the target recently tried to climb after the Eagles won the Super Bowl. Jay Widener, Oracle of Retrieving DNA by sending hundreds of business reply cards until the recipient gets a mighty paper cut and mails it anyway. Mikhail, Oracle of Retrieving DNA by stealing somebody's Harvey Wallbanger glass. And the crew of Erebus, Oracle of Retrieving DNA by using well-trained Labrador Retrievers. Additionally, I'd like to thank Archmaster Andrew Adelstein, Archmaster Brad the Blue, Archmaster Dan Svensson, Archmaster Derek Simsek, Archmaster Leroy Bryce, Archmaster Morgan Aran, Archmaster Nathan Weaver, Alex, Alexia, Ambiversion, Anders S., Anon, Bedurfi, Birdo, Blaze Hibbert, Blake Ryan, Brandon, Bryce Perry, Bubba the Pale One, Chris Blake, Sin Shotis, Daniel Cuppen, Daniel Scribner, Darren Hennessy, David Roy, Dennis Osborne, Eli Levenger, Eric Schwenk, Fragarock, George Lara, Henry Kraft, Ia Bull, Jason Kennedy, Jason Vines, Jason W. Briggs, Jay Gatsby, Jeff Brin, Jenna F., John Magnuson, Jolan Andes, Lawson Stuff, Joshua Heath, Kathleen Halperin, Chris Kinner, Leslie Weatherstone, Matthew Poyle, Michael Creedle, Michael Parker, Nathan Weaver, Nibero, Neil Patterson, Nikita Klamenov, Oliver Schindler, Patrick Mulder, Patrick McNamara, Rachel Grace, Richard Bat Brewster, Robart the Robot, Rubem Joseph, Ryan Stray, Rob H., Ryan Kendi, Samuel Tobin, Starfish, Stephen Carton, Thrice Great, Vincent Hamilton, Walter, William Connolly, and William Martin. Our EP shout-out this week is to Sin Shotis. Originally thought it was Sin Shatis, which was going to have me talk about morally aberrant fish, but instead, when I type Sin Shotis into Google, I get, did you mean sunshades? This led me to the idea of launching solar shades into Earth's orbit to reduce incident light and reduce global heating. Apparently something like a 1,000-kilometer-long Fresnel lens a few millimeters thick could do the trick. I have no idea if this would work, let alone what the climate impact would be of launching that many craft and the resultant damage to the ozone layer, but I got thinking, how would a technocrat solve this? Immediately thought of popularizing rhinestones to increase the albedo of the Earth, maybe on hats. Convincing people to consume sulfur compounds at incredibly high altitude to improve, I don't know, sexual performance or something, and to help disperse incoming light. And that we should finally force people who raise nitrogen oxide-producing bacteria as pets to just plain stop. When I think of sending 3,000 square miles of plastic into space, I'll think of you. Rather listen on YouTube? Search Mage the Podcast on YouTube to find our full library there. If you super like this episode or super didn't, drop us a line at magethepodcast@gmail.com or at magethepodcast on Twitter. We have a hop in Discord community at discord.me/magethepodcast. We're also on Mastodon at dice.camp/@magethepodcast. If you like us, please give us a review on the platform of your choosing or tell a friend about us. Also go to magethepodcast.com for show notes and all of our previous shows. Now go change reality. Bye.